We're talking about pulling down strongholds. So take your Bibles and turn to 2 Corinthians 10, 3 through 5, where Paul kind of lays out a strategy for how we are to envision or how we're to view talking with unbelievers. And he uses this term. We talked yesterday about the legal term of apologetics, presenting a defense for what we believe. Now we're talking about the nature of what that looks like. So 2 Corinthians 10, beginning in verse 3, Paul says, "For though we walk in the flesh," that is, we're human beings, we live in a physical world, "we are not waging war according to the flesh." That is, we don't have a jihad to take up. We don't fight with swords and guns for the sake of Christ. He says, "For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but they have divine power to destroy strongholds." And then he goes on to say, "We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God and take every thought captive to obey Christ." So Paul gives us here a kind of a model of viewing our encounters with unbelievers as warfare, that one of our goals is to figure out what does the unbeliever believe, and then to seek to destroy that, not the person, but to destroy their confidence in what they believe so we can present Christ. Notice the verse in Proverbs 21:22. "A wise man scales the city of the mighty and brings down the stronghold in which they trust." So let's take a look at what we're talking about here. And here's a couple of good metaphors for how we do apologetics. We're trying to pull the rug out from under their feet. That is, a lot of people think, when an unbeliever raises a challenge, you know, how can you believe the Bible when it's so full of myths, that we're supposed to come back with an answer, and we're just going to, like two rams, just keep hitting heads with each other to see who has the better evidence. And if you've ever tried that, you know it's extremely discouraging. Unless you're an argumentative person, it's not enjoyable. And many times the unbeliever walks away saying, "Ah, I showed that Christian," because in their minds, their arguments are better. So if you think about it, if I were hearing someone and we were able to pull the rug out from under their feet, the idea there is they would have no place to stand. So when I'm talking to a non-Christian, my goal is to find out what they believe and then to undermine their confidence in that. Another good example would be disarming unbelievers. So if someone comes at you with a challenge, how can you believe in God when there's so much evil and suffering in the world? I want to, before I give an answer to that, ask them, what do you mean by evil and suffering? Why do you think that's a problem? In other words, make them defend their challenge before I seek to give an answer. So here's what I want to do. First of all, I want to challenge the authority of the unbeliever's belief system. That is, I want to find out, what are they trusting in? Are they trusting in their own mind to tell them the truth? Are they trusting in their religion? Are they trusting in something their high school biology teacher told them regarding the way the world came about? I want to figure out, what are they trusting in for their whole belief system, and I want to go after that. Notice, to destroy a stronghold, the idea there is to reveal the weakness of the authority that the unbeliever trusts in. That is, I know this, if they are not a Christian, if they don't trust ultimately in Christ, then whatever they're trusting in is will fail when we look at it. Think about in the Old Testament, the way the Old Testament talks about false gods. In Isaiah says, you know, think about how, am I on your way there? There you go. This happens in class all the time. I'm standing right in the middle of the PowerPoint. Students are craning their heads all around. Think about how this works in a conversation. Someone raises an objection, and if we take the time to ask them, what do you mean by that objection? And get them to have to explain it, a lot of times they can't explain it. And here's the reason why. Most people you meet will have thought like an inch deep about everything in the world. What do you think about the environment, the economy, right and wrong, you know, things in Russia, things in Israel? You know, most people have an opinion, but as soon as you dig deeper than that one inch by asking questions, I've had a lot of people say, well, I really don't know. a good example is I was at the podiatrist, the foot doctor, one time, and she was Vietnamese. And she was Chinese. And I know that most Chinese people are either atheists or Buddhists. So I started the conversation by saying, oh, tell me about China. What part are you from? And, you know, how long have you been in the United States? And I said, let me ask you a question. Most Chinese people, from what I understand, are either Buddhist or atheist. So which are you? And she said, I'm a Buddhist. I said, oh, interesting. I know a little bit about Buddhism, but can you tell me what it's kind of about? And she said, well, I really don't know. I tell people I'm a Buddhist, but I really don't know anything about it. And see, if I had launched into this big, like, corrective of Buddhism, I would have missed the point entirely because she didn't even know what it was all about. And by asking questions and not assuming that I know, I was able to then move right to, well, what do you know about Christianity since you've been in the United States? So we got past that hurdle because we took the time to ask questions. So here are some of the questions I want to ask. Ask questions that force the person to reveal the foundations of their beliefs. Now again, not physically, don't put them in like a headlock or twist their arm. But when someone presents a challenge to the Christian faith, turn around and ask them questions. The general rule in apologetics is if you don't know what to say, ask a question. This happens to me all the time. People will throw things at me and think, I have never heard that before. And I've read a lot of books on apologetics. Where did you get that idea from? Simply, whenever you're stuck and you're thinking, I don't know what to say, ask a question about what they've said. So these questions I'm about to give you, I've spent years in a laboratory developing these. They're patented, so please make sure you go online and pay every time you use. No, these are simple. You're going to think, like, I can't believe he had to go to school for these. And others are thinking, I can't believe we're paying this guy to come here and give us these basic things. And others of you are saying, we're paying this guy? So these are, if you ask me, like, Mark, when you talk to an unbeliever, what does it look like? This is all I do. I ask questions like, what do you mean by that? You're like, that's it? Yeah, it's really that easy. In other words, someone throws an argument at me. Well, you know, Christians are such hypocrites. Well, when you say the word hypocrite, what do you mean by that? No, I don't ask questions endlessly. I'm trying to see if, yeah, that would be fun. Just like, why are you asking me questions? Why are you asking me that question? It's not that way, like junior higher would do to torment their mother or something like that. Junior hires don't do that kind of thing, do they? No, okay. They don't torment their mothers. But I'm asking questions to see if they have a real reason that they're throwing that challenge at me. Sometimes they don't really have a reason, or sometimes they have a really good question, and by asking a question in return, I'm helping them clarify their thinking. So I'm asking questions like, what do you mean by that? Well, Christians are dangerous people. Now, what do you mean when you say that? A lot of times people say things like, well, I don't know. That's just, I read a headline that said that. Oh, okay. Well, do you really think that's true? In other words, if I get all worked up about the challenge they throw at me before I take the time to question it, it could be for no reason because they may not really believe it. Why do you believe that? Well, I'm a Buddhist. Well, that's interesting. Why are you a Buddhist? I'm an atheist. Why are you an atheist? I don't believe in God. Interesting. Why not? In other words, this is all I do because if I can get them to talk about what they believe, because I know if it's not rooted in Christ, then it will not pass an examination. It will fail when they need it. It is not rational ultimately. By asking these questions, I'm helping them understand for themselves that many times they believe things and they don't know the reason. Here's another one. How do you know that? Well, don't you know that you're more likely to be assaulted by an evangelical Christian than by anyone else in the world? Really? How do you know that? Where'd you get that from? Where'd you read that? Oh, I don't know. I just heard that. So do you believe everything you hear? Like, that's basically how I would respond to something like that. What do you base that on? Don't you know all religions are essentially the same? Now, can I ask you a question? What do you base that on? Have you studied world religion? Most people, well, no. But they all seem to have similarities. Well, yeah, they do have some similarities. Many religions, there's prayer or there's a gathering for worship. But in the substance, the real depth of religion is radically different in every faith. And by pushing back, they start to lose confidence in what they believe before I ever start to present the positive truth of the gospel. How have you come to that conclusion? You say, Mark, these all sound like really similar. Yeah, they are. They're just variations on a theme. But again, resting in the confidence of what we've learned yesterday, that any truth outside of God is going to fail when we look at it closely, and that unbelievers build up these idolatrous counter-religions and they suppress the truth, I know that they cannot stand up to these questions. Where did you get that idea? And we could go on and on. Here's a few more. Who said that? Is that source reliable? Can you give me an example of that? So you don't have to write down all of these. Hopefully by now you get the gist. But when someone says, oh, there's so many errors in the Bible, hopefully, I mean, this has been around for a long time, hopefully you would know to say, well, can you show me an example of that? And yesterday I shared the illustration of the guy who thought Jesus had sinned. So when I pushed back on that a little bit, he admitted he didn't really know, and then he threw out an example, and when I explained that it wasn't Jesus sinning, he conceded the point right away, like, oh, I guess you're right, I guess Jesus never sinned. And now, not all the people you meet, but most of the people you meet, if you ask these questions, they will show that they really don't know why they believe that. Or they saw it on a YouTube video. Or they saw it on a meme, and they believe it because they saw it on a meme, if you know what a meme is. So these are the questions I ask, and by doing this, as they throw up objections to the Christian faith, I'm now, here's what they do. If you remember the game Foursquare, if you ever played that, it's basically made up of four squares. And when someone pushes the ball into your square, you've got to push it into someone else's. So when someone pushes the ball toward you and raises an objection, a lot of Christians hold it and think, oh no, what am I going to do with this? I don't know how to answer. Just push it right back by asking a question. And what you'll often find with people is, after a few questions, they've run out of the reasons why they believe what they believe. And this is why, as Christians, it's important that we know why we believe what we believe, that we know what the Scriptures say, that we have good reasons for what we believe. And many times, you find that that person will find it fascinating that you know more about what you believe than they know about what they believe. Because most people think of Christians as irrational people. Like, you crazy people believe in God. I'm the rational one. I don't believe in that stuff. And very quickly, that can get turned around. And here's what happens. As you ask those questions, all the kids are like, when's he going to play with the Jenga? As you ask those questions, they start to lose confidence in their beliefs. And every time you ask a question or correct something that they believe that's wrong, is you are knocking down portions of the tower of their belief system. And let's go a little bit further. Notice unbelievers typically rely on the following authorities. Some would say science. Only what can be observed is fact. That's not really science. That's scientism, the belief that only what we find in the natural world is true. But many people think that's what science teaches. Religion is faith, not knowledge. Again, real science doesn't argue that, but many people put their trust in science. There's a couple of good books on science back there. A brand new one out by the Oxford professor John Lennox, Can Science Explain Everything? And he talks about all the things that science can't explain. And yet certain people like Richard Dawkins and others, famous atheists, would say, science tells us everything. And John Lennox, in a nice little book, shows how it does not tell us everything. Other people trust, an advertising campaign that they had in England a few years ago. There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. Okay. Now, if someone were to say that to you, what kind of questions would you ask of them? Or what's wrong with that statement? What would you want to push back on? What's that? When is there a God? Okay, yeah, the question of probably, what do you do with probably? Like, they're telling people, you know, go enjoy your life because there's probably no God. Is it like 51%, do you think, or 49? What's the percentage? Dan? Okay, yeah, why are you worrying? There's another problematic word in there, enjoy. Is life just about enjoyment? Isn't life about other things too? So if there is no God, what happens then when I lose someone I love? What do I do then? What's the meaning and purpose of that? Here's another one. Katharine Hepburn, famous actress. I'm an atheist and that's it. I believe there's nothing we can know except that we should be kind to each other and do what we can for other people. How would you ask questions or push back on that statement? That's right. Why? If there is no God, then why kindness? Why not cruelty and aggression? Why not deception and subterfuge? Those things all work, too, to get you ahead. Why kindness? What else would you want to push back on? Okay, yeah, are you going to be kind to everyone? What if there's a conflict in that kindness? I believe there's nothing we can know except this. How would you want to push back on that? How can you know that? Katharine Hepburn is telling us you can't know anything except this one truth. My question is, how do you know that truth? How did you arrive at that? What led you to believe that's the only thing that we can know? See, this sounds really intelligent to many people, but it's so full of assumptions that we need to challenge. It would be kind of like if, you know, kids, if you came into your mom and say, listen, mom, there's nothing we can know except that I need a cookie right now. You know, is that going to convince your mom? Probably not. Your mom's going to say, how do you know that's the only thing that we can know? Here's another one. You can be good without God. What would you want to push back on? What words? What do you mean by good? Who defines what is good? The abortion doctor thinks that he's doing good for someone. We would say, that's not good. You're taking a life. Who gets to decide good? Is it the philosophers, the politicians? If it's the politicians, then good is determined by force. And so we live in a world where the stronger you are politically or physically, however it might be, you determine right. And then we're into some kind of a dystopian world where, you know, dark things rule and reign. So how can I be good if we can't even define good? So if you think in your mind when someone presents a challenge, what are they assuming? And I need to challenge that. You can many times with the average person make them stop and think, oh, that's a good question. I never thought about that before. And what that is when you do that is you're simply testing where they believe and then, oh, they don't need that belief. Let me take that away. And after a while, they start to notice, wow, I was really confident in my beliefs. Now I'm not so sure. Let's move on. Notice some other things. Some people would say only what the mind and society deem to be reasonable is true. That is, let's be rational and reasonable. But the question is, whose reason, whose rationality? Here's another one, philosophy. Only what intellectuals in academic institutions believe is true. Let's trust the philosophers. I can assure you, let's not trust the philosophers. I did a year of external study at Villanova University in German philosophy, and I do not trust philosophers. Peter Singer at Princeton University is an ethicist and philosopher, and he's written multiple books on articles arguing that parents should have up to 3 weeks after a baby's born to decide whether it lives or not. Not whether they keep it, but whether it lives or not. That's what philosophers argue about, so don't trust the philosophers. Or religion, some would argue that sincerity is all that God, however you conceive him or her or it or they, requires. So most people trust in one of these several things. And by asking questions, I'm going to figure out what it is and I'm going to challenge those authorities. How do we know that truth comes from them? They might turn around and say, well, how about for you as a Christian? I believe in the eternal God who's revealed himself in Scripture. Can I show you something in the Bible? I'll show you. Here's why I believe what I believe. I always want to try to get people to be willing to look at the Bible because the Word of God is powerful. And many people have been saved simply by reading the Scriptures. So notice also, I want to challenge arguments against the Christian worldview. First of all, I want to test the consistency and livability of his worldview. Here's a good example of inconsistent worldview. Some people would say, I believe in evolution, and I believe we should be kind to one another, and we should strive for human flourishing and empathy. My question is, or my response is, those are inconsistent. Evolution says natural selection runs everything. The fittest survive, so the weak die off. If that's the case and I'm alive, I'm going to look out for myself to make sure that I continue on. And if that requires me stepping on you, then that's what I'll do because I want to be part of the fittest that survives. So why should I be kind? Kindness is a form of weakness. If I, as an evolutionary person, if I really believe it, that the fittest survive, that I'm going to try to be as strong as I can, I'll be as aggressive as I can, and I'm going to hope that all of you go for the kindness bit, because that will make it all the easier to crush you when necessary. So I would tell people, if you believe in evolution, kindness is one possible choice, but you can't get upset with people who choose cruelty and aggression, because if that's all there is, then that's a perfectly legitimate option. And here's the problem is most people, because they're made, all people are made in the image of God, most people would say, well, no, that's not right. You shouldn't be cruel. Well, why do you feel that way? And this is the reason is they cannot escape the fact that they're made in God's image. So they're fighting against their very intuition as people. Why are they saying that we should be kind to one another? Because they know the truth of the love of God, that we ought to be kind. And yet they choose a worldview, evolution, that goes against that. Here's another one. Call his bluff. That is, sometimes unbelievers will bluff. They'll say things that they know are not true just to see if you'll fall for it. So at the end of every semester, I have my skeptic friend come into my apologetics class. And last year, he threw something at my students that they weren't prepared for. He said, don't you know, you believe the Bible's true? Yes. Don't you know that when Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt, see, he reads his Bible, so he knows these stories. Don't you know that when Moses led the people of Israel out of Egypt, by the time the first line of people would have reached the promised land, the last of the people would not even have crossed through the Red Sea yet? And all the students were like, I don't know what to say. No one's ever said that to me before. He said, even if they walked 1,000 wide, you believe there was 2 or 3 million people, right? Yes, because the Bible says 600,000 men. So the first people, if they're walking 1,000 people wide on the path to the promised land, by the time they reach the end, the last people wouldn't even be through the Red Sea because that area is the size of Rhode Island and you couldn't fit that many people in there. So normally, back in those days, I didn't get involved. I just let him challenge the students and the students answer back. So I was sitting off the side, so I started Googling the size of that area across from the Red Sea leading up to Palestine. And number one, he was completely wrong about the size. But then secondly, I used to live right near the state of Rhode Island. Rhode Island has about 800,000 people in it, and when you drive through, it seems empty. So he's completely wrong that 2 or 3 million people couldn't have fit in that area. So I, uncharacteristically, I raised my hand. I said, actually, Scott, you're completely wrong about this, and here's the reason why. His response was, oh, okay, well, I guess I was wrong. In other words, he was bluffing. And sometimes people bluff, and you've got to say things like, you know, that doesn't sound right to me. I'm going to look it up and get back to you on that. But I don't think that's right. Or if you know the facts, you know, well, don't you know that the Gospels each record something different that Jesus said in his last words? And it's true. Each Gospel records a different last word of Jesus. Because none of them are trying to record his ultimate last words. They're sharing from different perspectives because the Gospels have different purposes. They're sharing different things Jesus said. And so they'll bluff and say, oh, see contradictions right there in the Gospels. And no, that's not the case at all. Rather, they're focusing on some of the final words of Jesus. And I forget which Gospel it is that has the actual last words of Jesus. But that's a bluff. So if someone throws up something to you and you think, oh, I don't know how to answer that, tell them, that doesn't sound right to me. Let me look it up and get back to you. Here's another one. Correct his misunderstandings or misconceptions about the Christian faith. That is, many people think things that simply aren't true. A good example is Muslims think that we believe the Trinity is God the Father, Jesus the Son and Mary the Mother. So when you're talking to a Muslim, make sure if you start talking about the Trinity, that you help them to know that that's not what we believe the Trinity is. Because if you don't correct that misunderstanding, they'll be talking about how weird the Trinity is and how it's not logical, and you might not realize that you're talking past each other. Top of the back page, show how the Christian faith can answer any legitimate challenge leveled against it. That is, we have to rest in the confidence that even if we don't know the answer to all their challenges, there are good answers. And there are. In my own personal odyssey, as I tried to find all the answers to the challenges, I came to realize there is nothing in philosophy, there's nothing in science, there's nothing in history that can be raised against the Christian faith for which there are not good answers. So it's out there. There are good answers out there, even if you don't know them. And then finally, if you don't know, say so. So the whole time you're talking to an unbeliever, you're asking questions, you're responding to their challenges, and little by little, sometimes all in one conversation, sometimes over a number of conversations, or weeks, or perhaps years in a relationship, you are chipping away at their belief system, and it starts to look full of holes. And eventually what's going to happen is, one day, their belief system's going to collapse, and they're going to say, wow, I don't even know what I believe anymore. And so one of my goals is to chip away at their belief system so I can show them, here's your belief system. It's crumbling. It can't answer all these questions. Here's the Christian faith. And I begin to, early on, as I ask questions, weave in, oh, that's interesting you believe that. I believe that, too, as a Christian, but it makes sense in my worldview. Why do you believe it? Or here's your worldview, you can't account for evil and suffering, but here's the answer Christians give. I want to set in contrast their worldview and the Christian worldview. I want them to be able to see Christ has the answer. Your worldview is increasingly unable to answer those things. And that can be powerful. People can come to realize, my goodness, I thought it was okay. I thought my worldview made sense, but it can't answer the most important questions. So very quickly, then, number three, I want to press one of the two buttons that get to the root of arguments against Christianity. I want to ask, how do you know what you know? That's what we've done so far by asking, how do you know that? Where did you get that from? That's called epistemology. But then I also want to ask ethics questions. That is, what is right and wrong and makes them so? Every belief system has an understanding of right and wrong. And so my question is always, what makes something right and wrong? And this comes from Rabbi Zacharias. If people say something like, how can you believe in God when there's so much evil in the world? Notice in your notes, ask, do you believe in evil? Well, most of the time, ask that question, then yes, they do. If you argue for evil, you must also believe. We won't take the time to look at the Calvin and Hobbes cartoon, unfortunately. If you believe in evil, you must also believe in good that stands in contrast to evil. So people say, you know, how can you believe in God and there's so much evil? So there's evil in the world? Yes. So is there good too? Yes. Good implies a moral law to distinguish between good and evil. So I'll ask the question, so in your worldview, in your belief system, how do you know the difference between good and evil? How do you know homicide is bad and hugging is good? Killing is bad and kissing is good. How do you know the difference? Well, sometimes people say, we just know that. No, all around the world, people have different ideas about what's good and evil. So what do you base yours in? Is it just your own personal idea of good and evil? We'll look at that in just a moment. Or is there something universally right and wrong? A really good example is when we were in Oxford a year and a half ago, I was teaching a class while we were there on philosophy. Ryan was in the class, and we had several people in the class that were unbelievers. One was a very outspoken atheist girl, college student. And I was asking the question, are good and evil relative? And she said, yes, it's all relative. Beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And so I said, okay, so can murder be considered beautiful? And I remember her face like she had never thought of that before. I said, if we can each decide for ourselves what's beautiful and good, then can someone look at murder and say, oh, it's so beautiful? And she's like, that wouldn't make sense, would it? I said, no, it doesn't. And she came to the realization, like, then there's got to be some kind of a moral standard, because everyone ought to know that that's wrong. That can't be beautiful. And I think for the first time in her life, her atheism was challenged. And the first couple of days, she was very adamant, because the rest of us were Christians, the students and me. Yes, I was a Christian then too. And that was like the second or third day. Her whole demeanor changed after that, where she was much more open to discuss, because she had never been challenged in her thinking about right and wrong. And Rabbi Zachariah says, if there is a moral law, there has to be a moral law giver, that is an intelligent being who gives this moral law. So ultimately, the question, how can there be a God when there's so much evil in the world, doesn't even make sense unless you include in that a moral law giver, a God who gives that moral law. So you can't even ask the question unless you believe in God. Here's a simpler one that's a little bit complicated. I've used this a number of times. How do you decide between good and evil? So notice the circles there. A lot of people will say, well, right and wrong is personal. We each decide for ourselves. So in the center of the circle, right, personal. I've had lots of people tell me this. We each decide for ourselves what's right and wrong. Oh, okay. So what happens if I decide that it's okay for me to take your things or to harm you? That's okay because we each decide? And they'll often say, well, no, I think society tells us, so they retreat one level, the middle circle. Society tells us that that's wrong. Oh, society, okay. What happens if you're living in an ISIS-controlled area or Nazi Germany in the 1930s, where they had a whole different set of right and wrong? So that those societies are okay? Well, no, obviously ISIS is wrong. The Nazis were wrong. Well, how can you say that? That was their society. Well, common sense, and then they retreat one more level. Common sense tells us that those societies were wrong. Oh, common sense, okay. So right and wrong depends on common sense. And then I'll often say, don't you know that all around the world, different peoples and cultures have different ideas of what common sense is? There's no universal agreed upon idea of common sense. I've had people say, well, then where do we get our sense of right and wrong? I say, I'm so glad you asked. There has to be something outside of us, something transcendent, which tells us right from wrong. Otherwise, we just go back into the circle and it's just you decide for yourself. Well, that doesn't work. Society, that doesn't work. Common sense, that doesn't work. We all desire something outside of ourselves to impose a moral law so that we know how to live. And now we're talking about God. So many times I will ask people this moral question, what do you believe about right and wrong? There is, by the way, in the top philosophy books of our day, you cannot argue for right and wrong from an atheistic viewpoint. No one disputes that. Atheists keep trying, but they keep being shown that they're wrong. So if someone doesn't believe in God, they cannot talk about right and wrong. But here's the thing. If you talk to an atheist long enough, they'll start slipping in the word right and wrong. You shouldn't do that. Wait, whoa, whoa, time out. How can you say shouldn't? You're an atheist. There's no way to possibly say right and wrong. You can only say that if you believe in a God. Oh, okay. And then we go a little bit further. Well, you ought to. No, no, time out. You can't say ought. That's a sense of right and wrong. If you don't believe in God, then you're just telling me your opinion. It's no different than saying I like chocolate better than vanilla when you say people shouldn't kill one another. Only in the Christian worldview does it make sense. And here's the thing is, as you're talking to unbelievers, they're made in the image of God. They have the moral law implanted in their heart, and they're trying to deny it. And that keeps rising up, and they forget that, and they will say things, and you could say, that makes sense in the Christian worldview, but not in your worldview. So this is essentially what I'm trying to do as I'm talking to an unbeliever. And as I'm doing that, I'm showing and talking about Jesus and how Christ is the answer. Our real problem is sin, and Christ has died for us. So Ryan's going to come up now. He's going to play the part of the unbeliever, and we're going to have a chat. I don't know what he's going to say. He's going to throw some objections at me, and I'll show you the kind of thing that I try to say. So we'll pretend we're at a coffee shop.
All right.
Okay. So, hey, what are you reading there?
I'm just reading this book by the Humanist Society for America about how we should all pursue our own happiness and self-actualization.
Oh, interesting. Now, when you say self-actualization, what do you mean by that?
Well, I just mean, you know, working on ourselves so that we reach our fullest potential as human beings in order to impact the world and reach that higher goal of being a fully evolved being.
Ah, interesting. What would it look like to be a fully evolved being? Like, does anybody know that yet?
Well, you know, we're still working on it. We're still figuring it out. But I think being a fully evolved being means that you find all the happiness in the world in yourself. You make choices that aren't self-destructive. And you are kind and loving to people. And you are helping other people reach their self-actualization as well.
Okay. Well, that's good. I mean, that would sounds like it'd be a great world to live in. But what happens if trying to help someone else interferes with your own self-actualization? Do you choose to help them, or do you do your own thing?
Well, I mean, I think that you would have to choose your own happiness over that person because, you know, you can't make somebody else happy, but you can make yourself happy.
Okay. So what if everyone then turned to doing their own thing, making themselves happy? Wouldn't that cause conflict in society?
Well, I mean, I think that deep down inside, we know what's good and we know what's bad. So I think that we could all work together to find our happiness in things that are good.
Okay. Now, when you say good and bad, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you know, things that, you know, help people, like, you know, recycling water bottles, you know, donating different things, you know, taking care of charities, all those things, you know. And, you know, wrong things are pretty obvious, you know, murdering, stealing, being intolerant towards certain peoples. And
okay. Now, as a Christian, I agree with you on some of that stuff, that we ought to love one another. But that's because I believe God's revealed himself and he's a loving God and he's shown us that we ought to love one another. But where do you get your belief system from that we ought to be good to one another?
Well, I mean, I think it's just obvious. I think we just know it.
Yeah. What do you do with people that are evil and cruel and aggressive and they say that's their worldview? How could you oppose that?
Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, they haven't reached their fullest potential as a human, and they're only responding that way because they are missing out on certain needs.
Okay. So would you call yourself an evolutionist?
Yeah, I would call myself an evolutionist.
Yeah. Isn't the main principle of evolution natural selection, where the strong survive and the weak die out?
Yeah.
Yep. If that's the case, why would I... Let's say I'm a strong person, I've got resources and I've got physical strength. Shouldn't I focus on growing stronger and propagating my own genes rather than helping people? Isn't that what natural selection teaches?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've never thought about it that way. I guess that would be, but I think, you know, I think we know that that's not right.
Yeah. How would we know that, though?
You know, well, I mean, I feel it in my heart that that's not right.
Oh, okay. That's good. Now, some of what you said, again, I would agree with as a Christian because...
Oh, nice. You're a Christian.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know much about Christianity?
Well, I mean, I know that it's a, you know, it's. I think it's a nice thing, but I think Christians aren't very nice. I think they could be more tolerant towards peoples and their life choices and just kind of mind their own business.
But... Have you met Christians like that? Is that why you say that?
Yeah, well, you know... Down outside this coffee shop, people are waving signs and preaching hate, and so I just, you know, mind my own business.
Okay. What are the signs saying that you think is hateful?
Well, you know, just things like, you know, God's judgment is coming.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Yeah. So do you think there's judgment for people that do wrong or not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the government, you know, will judge them. And yeah.
Okay. What if we lived in a society where the government said things like cruelty and assault and things like that was okay? Like, would you condemn the government then, and on what basis?
I don't think a society like that has ever existed.
Yeah. Have you studied history at all?
Yeah, you know, I dabble in a little bit of history.
Yeah, because in Germany in the 1930s and other places, you know, it was kind of a cruel society where they did away with certain people groups.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if that were my government, then I guess I wouldn't trust the government.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. What do you know about Jesus? As a Christian, my focus is on Jesus, and that's what the Christian faith is all about.
I think Jesus is great. I think he was a great guy with a lot to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we could all learn from him as a good moral teacher.
Okay. So do you believe he was God?
No, I don't believe he was God.
Yeah. Have you ever read the New Testament at all, where it talks about the things Jesus said?
No, I You know, I haven't read the New Testament at all, you know, any of the Gospels or any things like that. I've only ever seen things that people have posted on Facebook, you know, kind of speaking hate about certain groups of people.
Okay. What would you think if I told you that Jesus called himself God and said that apart from him, a person couldn't get to heaven or be reconciled to God?
I mean, I've never heard of that before.
Okay. All right, we'll stop there just for the sake of time. Nice. Sometimes it's a little bit more aggressive. But you can see that most of the time I'm asking questions to get to the root of their belief and then beginning to weave in my Christian faith and talk about Christ. And the goal is always to get to the person of Christ. This is why I try to avoid politics. I try to avoid talking about creationism and evolution a lot because I'm not trying to convince them of that. If they get saved, God will convince them of that. I want to talk to them about Jesus, who he is and what he claimed. So again, as you're talking with unbelievers, ask questions, challenge them on things that they bring up that aren't true or are mistaken, and seek to weave in the Christian gospel. And you would be surprised if you ask questions that reveal their lack of knowledge or show them that they're wrong. People tend to be more open at that point, and you can present that more fully. All right, let's pray, and then we'll be dismissed.